In it to win it. This is Steve Barton, and today we have Rick Rule, investor, speculator, former CEO of Sprott Asset Management, just a real educator. And he's got his website, ruleinvestmentmedia.com, and he's got a upcoming uranium boot camp, which I am very excited for. I've signed up for it, and we will tell you guys how you can be a part of that towards the end of the show. Rick, thank you for coming on the show.
Steve, I'm a fan. Thank you for having me on.
Yes. I was talking with Callie earlier. I'm doing air quotes, your supervisor, and she had nothing but good things to say about you. Just that you're a real down-to-earth guy, and I've personally been following you for maybe about a year, and you have an ability to articulate and use your vocabulary to tailor it to your audience and instruct and educate in a way that you can really dumb down very complex subjects and deliver them in a manner that is digestible. And it's
Kind of you to say. I hope that's because at age 69, I've chosen to limit the number of subjects that I comment on. Were people to talk to me about, say, technology stocks or baseball, or most of human existence, which I'm not particularly interested in, I'd probably fumble around a lot. If you keep me to those topics that I'm interested in, if I have the discipline to stay with topics I know, I've come to believe that I have the ability to communicate effectively, probably because I limit what I talk about.
humble. I like it. I'd like to just get your general take on what's your current assessment of the global economy?
Really mixed, and I know that doesn't help people. They want red or red, but really mixed. There is a lot of cash on the sidelines, a lot of cash. There's a lot of debt too, but the debt isn't always held by the people who have the cash. And I think in the near term, there's a lot of cash that finds a home, that wants to find a home. And there is a bit of a relief rally that takes place as inevitably the COVID restrictions decline. I think an increase in economic activity. I think that belays bigger problems, however. That's why I say mixed. I believe that the conditions that we've gone through over the last 40 years have been the most benign economic conditions in the history of mankind. If you look at, as an example, declining interest rates, a bond bull market for 40 years, which lowered the cost of capital and increased the capitalized value of equity distribution, so a stock bull market. If you look too at the benefits that we got from global trade and globalization, from the demographic of the baby boomers, coming into the economy, we've had 40 absolutely spectacular years, which I'm grateful for. I think they're over. And that isn't to say that we're going to go to hell in a handbasket, but the tailwinds is an example that we've enjoyed from declining interest rates. Think about the interest rate on the US 10-year Treasury going from 15.5 to sub 2. How much lower does it go? If the interest rate doesn't go on, then the bond bull market is over. And arguably, the ever-increasing capitalization of income streams from dividends is over. That's a bit of a challenge. I'm being charitable. What does continue in a positive sense is the incredible advances in technology. One of the things that saved us from our collective stupidity as voters over the last 40 years has been the fact that our societies were still creative and tenacious enough that five or six teenagers could commandeer a garage in Sunnyvale, California, and out popped Google. Something that made everybody's life easier and generated a whole bunch of money with no capital investment. A wonderful thing. And if you want to be positive about something, I think that the distributed learning through the web, which you're part of, and technology means that the next time a garage is commandeered and all of humanity benefits, that garage might be in Jakarta, or it might be in Lagos. It might be in La Paz. The idea that increasingly the poorest half of humanity has access to technology and communications and contribute in a way that only we used to be able to contribute is, from my point of view, the hidden white swan. You asked a big question, and I had to give you a big answer. My suspicion is for most people, the next 10 years will be a lot less generous than the last 40 years have been. But I suspect too that somehow we will find a way individually to finance our collective stupidity.
I like that. I would be remiss if I didn't talk about the current situation with Russia and the Ukraine. And I suppose this is a little selfish question here. I have mentioned these on the show before about Gazprom and Polymetal. And I was looking through online at the sanctions on the Treasury Department put out, and it looks like Gazprom's on the list. What are your thoughts? What risks are we taking by investing in Russian stocks right now? You know, it seems like an amazing opportunity to me, but I think our biggest risk is our own government saying that you can't. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I mean, I'll begin with the headline. The cheapest resource stocks in the world, by a large margin, fell in price by half. That is to say, the cheap got much cheaper. I'm a reasonably large shareholder in Russian stocks. In fairness, I portfolio sized them well. If my Russian stocks went to zero, I wouldn't be happy about it, but it wouldn't change my decision as to what to have for breakfast. The second headline is that I'm increasing my position. We'll talk some about that in a while. And the risks are manifold. Will Russian extractive industry companies be able to import the inputs that they need to continue to operate their business? If the answer to that is yes, will, if they are denied access to the SWIFT banking system, be able to find the currency to pay you and I those dividends that we've come to enjoy so much from those companies? Further, looking away from Russian risk, will the London Stock Exchange, where I buy my Russian stocks, kick them off? And finally, will my government, in their wisdom, allow me to own them? Those are all things that you must consider. A separate thing to consider is whether, as a consequence of Russian actions, you want to own those stocks at all. Part of the political risk comes within, a moral risk. And I've been confronted with owning stocks that present a moral risk to me as long as I've been investing. One could argue that given American military investments in, around adventures around the world, from a moral point of view, do we want to own American stocks? The answer, I guess, usually defaults to yes. But I think everybody, each individual investor needs to make the decision for him or herself. I'm not going to try to defend the Russian action by saying just because the stocks are cheap, you should own them. I think you need to make your own moral judgment, although I do think you need to take it in the context of moral judgments that you might make around other jurisdictions around the world, including that jurisdiction that you live in. I mean, make no mistake, the Russian stocks, the Russian resource stocks are cheap. And in addition to being cheap, they are high quality. A preponderance of tier one deposits, which is to say multi-decade deposits, lowest cash cost quartile worldwide, best quartile worldwide in return on capital employed. Importantly, the Russian stocks have owners. They're not owned by the index funds. They have these people with polysyllabic last names who are large shareholders, and as a consequence, demand that shareholders be treated well. So, in addition to earning lots of money, they're polite enough to return some of that money to its owners, unlike some Western stocks. So, they have a lot going for them, but they are by no means riskless.
Okay. Why is, and maybe you know, maybe you don't, why is Russia taking over Ukraine? It kind of looks to me like they're in a position that other countries can't really do anything about it. I mean, from what I read, Europe gets 40% of its oil and gas from Russia. We get 8%, the USA. China gets 15%, which is increasing year over year. It appears that Russia has made itself over the years less vulnerable to the US dollar. What am I missing?
Well, with the caveat that I'm not a geopolitical analyst,
Okay.
I'm a credit analyst. I'll give you a compendium of what I've read. In the first instance, Russia has historical nervousness about invasion. It's flat, sparsely populated, and they've always liked to control their frontiers. There is a school of thought in Russia, not shared in the Western Ukraine, that Ukraine is a historical part of Russia. And there are a lot of Russian-speaking people in the Ukraine. More complex, when German reunification took place, NATO made an explicit promise to Russia that it wouldn't move NATO east. The consequence of that is that the Russians conceded the return of East Germany and in fact facilitated it. Now, you know, lying in politics is not something that we haven't experienced before, but in terms of engendering trust for the West did itself an extraordinary disservice. And I think it's fair to say, and I'm not defending the Russian actions here, the West has not been blameless in the Ukraine. The United States participated aggressively in the destabilization of the original pro-Russian regime in the Ukraine. The idea that the first people who have interfered in Ukraine's domestic politics were Russian ignores a very successful American effort there. Further, the history of Ukrainian government is almost a case study in corruption. And my suspicion is that the Russians would have had less courage to invade Ukraine if the popularity of the Ukrainian government was higher than it is. In fact, the Russians, in one sense, have done the Ukrainian government a favor by legitimizing it, because their track record of the last two decades is virtually unblemished by success in any other realm. Finally, of course, the Ukraine before the Nord 2 pipeline was a constriction point for Russian natural gas sales to the West. And the Ukrainians were not above helping themselves to some gas that was coming through the pipeline that was meant for the West, and forgetting for substantially long periods of time to pay for it. So to suggest that the West or the Ukraine is blameless in the current circumstance is, I think, to ignore history. I'm not trying to belittle the impact or import of the Russian action. The idea that what the Russians are doing in deposing a Jewish Ukrainian president is fighting fascism is a little far-fetched from my viewpoint. But I'm very accustomed to the political elites in every country around the world justifying actions that they'd like to take by lying. I'm surprised that Mr. Putin didn't say that he'd found evidence of weapons of mass destruction in the Ukraine. Often the lies that the Russian political class tells are ones that they've copied from the masters of lie telling, which are the big democracies.
Okay. What are some, I'm thinking specifically of Poland and Russia, things like EPOL, EPOL, RSX. What are your thoughts on these, and what realistic sanctions that that the U.S. could do to limit these?
Well, I need to say that I mostly confine my activities to resource stocks. I look for sectors that I believe I have a knowledge advantage or a contact advantage in. I also invest in conventional financial services, but I have to say that the Polish banks and the Russian banks are complex enough. And my familiarity with banking regulations in Poland and Russia are naive enough that I don't pretend to be able to comment on those. Certainly, if the West got serious about sanctions, and we're not, we've done things like exempted Italian luxury goods. You know, somehow supplying Gucci loafers to the plutocrats in Russia is a step beyond. But more importantly, of course, we've exempted oil and gas. If we really wanted to punish the Russians, or conversely, if the Russians really wanted to punish us, but endure some pain in the context, each side could interrupt the flow of oil and gas from Russia to Europe. That would be very interesting, interesting in all kinds of contexts. Interesting because the largest economy in Europe, Germany, has decided they're going to rely on solar power where the sun doesn't shine. interesting too, because the only thing that Russia really does well, although they are developing an export weapons industry, but the only thing they really do well is pump oil and gas. So that would be a very, very, very interesting circumstance. And if they tried it, I suspect that the real beneficiaries would be the Totals and the Exxons and the Chevrons of the world, people that had the ability with 4 or 5 years of investment to really seriously ramp up production. There are some raw materials for which there is no alternative. I'm thinking, as an example, of palladium. 46% of the world's palladium comes from Russia. 16% of the world's platinum comes from Russia. The South Africans are incapable of increasing their palladium production. And there's enough political and economic instability in South Africa that one shouldn't look to replace Russian platinum with South African platinum. The Russians are also fairly efficient because of low energy costs in terms of their production of aluminum. And the ability that the world has, although Russia only supplies 6% of the world's aluminum, to deal with that will be interesting. But the most important impact, of course, will be the regionalized impact in Europe on any interruption in oil and gas. And make no mistake, that will be enormously inconvenient for both sides. The Russians have low debt, not so much because of fiscal rectitude as because people didn't want to lend them money, but that's a different story. And they have very high cash reserves, largely in gold. So they have the ability to exist for a while without selling oil and gas. But when I say for a while, that's the only thing they do.
Okay.
I mean, okay. That's it. And, you know, while Germany has winter, Russia has been known to suffer through some winters as well. So the ability that they would have to maintain even the economy that they have while still maintaining the fight in the absence of petroleum revenues, I don't think that would last long at all.
Okay.
And of course, we wouldn't want to deprive them of Gucci loafers, of course.
No. You can't do without those. It's right up there with food. What emerging markets do you like? What percentage of your portfolio is generally in emerging markets? Or maybe it's you're so plugged into so many different.
Ironically, if you had asked me 6 weeks ago, I would have said Russia. Well, I'll still say Russia. I think Turkey's oversold. I think there's risks in Turkey, but Turkey has a very young workforce. It has wonderful infrastructure, wonderful work ethic, wonderful resources, a great manufacturing base. So I'm attracted to Turkey. I'm attracted, if I swallow twice, to Nigeria. I think Nigeria finally has put their thumb on the fact that their leadership is the problem. And I'm not trying to say that Nigeria will become uncorrupt. I just think it'll be less corrupt. And again, you have a huge, young, brilliant labor force. You know, the greatest beneficiary of Nigerian intellectual capital is the United States. You know, you look at doctors in Atlanta, petroleum engineers in Houston. I think you have the chance in Nigeria to repeat in a smaller fashion what happened in China. Everybody knew with the success of the Chinese diaspora out of China that if you allowed Chinese people to be more free, they would rapidly become more rich. 35 years ago or whenever, when Deng Xiaoping said to be rich is glorious, he set off the greatest renaissance, economic renaissance in the history of mankind. And I think that could happen in Nigeria. If you allowed Nigerian people, who are spectacular merchants, if you've ever been assaulted by Nigerian street vendors in Paris, you know that they're persistent and tenacious. If you ever allowed that brilliance and that tenacity to impact Nigeria, I think you'd be surprised at the outcome. I think Brazil is limping along. It's always been its own worst enemy.
Okay.
But Brazil, again, has a young workforce. They have an enormous middle class, enormous poor class too, but enormous middle class, good infrastructure, good resources. I'm attracted to a lot of the emerging markets with one caveat. It's been a very long time since we had a global recession. And global recessions and liquidity squeezes hit countries and industries on the margins, the worst. And every country that I've just talked about is a marginal country. If we had a repeat of 2008 or something like that, or we had a repeat of 1982, all of those high hopes would be dashed.
an instant.
Quickly. Been there, done that. I'm speaking from experience, not to, you know, I'm hoping past is not prologue.
Okay. What do you think of Poland?
I don't know enough about Poland to know. My own personal experience with political risk in Poland has been bad. I was part of a group that, you know, legally stake some extension claims to the Cooper Schaefer, the wonderful copper silver horizon in Poland that the local mining company KGMH had neglected to stake. And they solved the problem extrajudicially through the courts. So my own experience is that, at least with regards to the rule of law, that Poland is a frontier on the way to becoming emerging. Okay. Those work themselves out. You know, I had a long experience in Serbia, and my own experience with political risk in Serbia was we ultimately prevailed. But it was an interesting circumstance, not necessarily because of the bad will of the Serbians, but simply because the tradition of the rule of law and the precedent around the rule of law with regards to extractive industries didn't exist. And we were part of the adventure of creating it. I'm glad that adventure's over.
Okay. I did an episode recently with Justin Hune, who's going to be on your, a very, very good show. Yeah. And we were talking, anyways, I had a friend, a dentist friend, that said she wanted to get into uranium. She wanted to get an ETF for it, but she only wanted to buy one. And she was debating between URA and URNM. And she asked me what I thought. And I thought, well, I think URNM is probably a little bit of a better bet. But, you know, either one, I don't think you can go wrong. And she said, well, why would you get URNM when it's $60 a share and URA is $20? It's more expensive. And that's when I realized she's looking at the share price.
Right.
She's not looking at what's under the whole fund. Can you go over the basics of fundamentals of investing and, you know, price to book, price to earning, price to sales, that kind of thing? Just kind of put it in a basic format for listeners.
So what I will do is I'll get your listeners interested enough that we'll do a subsequent discussion on it, because that's a very, very, very long question. Okay. Your friend made the classic mistake of confusing price with value. Price information is easy to get, and it's what consumers believe that they spend. Money is made on the delta between price and value. That is to say, the fact that a stock is selling for $10 isn't very valuable information if you don't have an opinion on its value. If you think the stock is worth $20, then the fact that it's selling for 10 is very interesting. Conversely, of course, if you think it's worth five and it's selling for 10, that's interesting too, for a different reason. And for the purposes of this discussion, the valuation discussion, I'm going to confine my remarks to natural resource-based businesses, because I think valuing resource businesses is a specific substance, subject, I don't want to confuse people with other metrics. It's important at the beginning with resource-based businesses that you understand that your business with any individual deposit is finite. Steve, if you and I owned a bakery, we could reasonably expect to bring flour and butter and salt and stuff in the thing and kick out bread for 100 years. So from that viewpoint, price earnings is very important. But a copper mine is not a bakery. At some point in time, every day that you mine copper, your business gets smaller. You can't
stand. You're consuming your capital.
Yeah, exactly. You can't stand on the outside and throw in butter and flour and stuff and have it make more copper. It doesn't work like that. So the first concept in natural resource investing is net present value. And I define net present value as the current value using whatever discount rate you think is appropriate. I use the US 10-year treasury rate, but that's too generous. And discounting future cash flows to get a net present value. Future cash flows I define as identified third-party verified reserves and resources that are developed or could be developed at current commodity prices. And I use commodity prices as either the spot or, in longer live deposits, the forward strip. In other words, you take the reserves and resources that companies identify that are currently economic. You schedule out cash flows based on current costs with escalators and current prices, and you arrive at a net present value number. If that net present value number varies substantially from the enterprise value. Enterprise value being defined as market cap plus debt minus net cash. That's what you pay for the business. The value is what you get. Then you have a very interesting circumstance. Too many people in resource-based businesses pay attention to price earnings. And because, as you've suggested, you're consuming capital in the resource business, that your business is finite. You need to continue to reinvent it. Price earnings are illusory. EBITDA is illusory too, because before depletion and depreciation in the mining and oil and gas business doesn't matter, because depletion and depreciation is so high. You can't give yourself the leisure of using EBIT or EBITDA in evaluating resource businesses. You need to look at free cash margin, that is to say, how much cash you generate, and how much of that cash is required for sustaining capital, and what surplus will be left over to develop new projects. And then you need to look at a concept called recycle ratio. By now, your listeners' eyes are glazing over, but you asked me the question, so I'll take the liberty of answering you.
This is gold. Don't keep going.
Recycle ratio is the number of units of reserve that a company historically has been able to generate relative to a unit of production. So let's say that Exxon produces a barrel of oil, just for fun. And let's say their cash margin on that barrel of oil, net of cash and depreciation, all that kind of stuff, is $40.
Okay.
Just for fun. And let's say that to produce the next barrel of oil will require sustaining capital from this barrel of $5. So you have, what, $35 left over. If Exxon traditionally has been able to reinvest $35 to create 1.2 or 1.3 barrels of oil, then they have a positive recycle ratio. They generate enough cash from existing production to grow their business qualitatively. But if their recycle ratio is substantially below that, then you need to understand that at the current share price, whatever your dividend you're getting is truly a consumption of capital. So the real things that you look at in valuing resource-based businesses, producing businesses, are net present value to enterprise value and recycle ratio. With exploration companies, it's a much tougher equation because, you know, even with PE, it's all P. There ain't no E, right? So yep. There you're doing something very different. That's probabilistic net present value. And that's really hard. In fact, I'm going to duck the exploration question. And if your people email you to the extent that they want to suffer through a discussion on valuing exploration companies, I'm happy to do it. I've spent 45 years at it with some success and some enormous failures along the way. But it's a subject near and dear to my heart that will bore the tears out of those listeners of yours who came here for Global Macro.
Impossible. Impossible. You know, what you're talking about exploration, you mentioned on Jordan Rogue Burns' show, The Daily Gold, that you thought exploration was undervalued.
I don't think I said undervalued. I believe that if you look at the junior exploration business worldwide, it's overvalued. If you merge every public junior around the world, there's what, 1,500 of them? Into one company, Junior Explorco. That company in a good year would lose $2 billion. In a bad year, it would lose $5 billion, measured by expenditures relative to takeover sales, you know, other monetizations. So what do you pay for a business that loses $2 billion a year? Do you pay 6 times losses, 9 times losses? If it's in favor, do you pay 15 times losses? That cynicism disguises the fact that 5% of the issuers generate such extraordinary economic performance that they add legitimacy and sometimes even luster to a sector that's a guaranteed money loser. Sure. What I said to Jordan was that society had underinvested in exploration and misinvested in exploration both for 30 years. There has been substantial malinvestment. At the same time that there's been overinvestment, there's been malinvestment. Because the exploration equation became not so much making a discovery, but rather getting enough data to make a 25 cent stock go to 45 cents, which is not the same thing as exploring legitimately for value. The returns that you can enjoy, that in fact I have enjoyed on the best issuers, admittedly with some clangers along the way, is extraordinary. And that opportunity exists precisely because so much capital is diverted in the public structure to the lame, the halt, and the blind. We did a study some years ago, when I say we, a young intern, which is financial English for slave, a young intern did a study for me. And I asked this young man to pull 25 Toronto Stock Exchange venture resource companies at random, take 5 years of their balance sheets and income statements, including the quarterlies, look at them, and tell me what he found. And he said, what are you looking for? And I said, no. It's easy to find it if I tell you what to find. You got to find it. Now, interestingly, I didn't have anything in mind for him to look for. I just wanted to see the way that this young man thought. And after about 10 days, he called me up. He says, okay, Rick, I got it. Interesting. What did you get? And he said, the median of the 25 companies I pulled spent 65% of the money raised over 5 years on general and administrative expense, and only 35% went in the ground. Oh. Now, I'm not suggesting to you that 25 is a representative sample, but I am suggesting that across the length and breadth of public exploration companies, that it's a very inefficient funding mechanism for exploration. And the consequence of that is that most management teams that you see have one or two incarnations, both failures, before they go off to selling cars or crypto or becoming pot stocks or something like that. And then you have other management teams that experience 10 or 12 or 14 successes. It's important if you're going to be in the junior business, and I love the junior exploration business, that you understand that the first important variable is people and their track record for success. Before you worry about the deposit, before you worry about the narrative, before you worry about the market, before you worry about any of that financial mumbo jumbo, remember that success is distributed very unequally. And look for people who have been successful in the past. That assumes that you're going to miss somebody's rookie success. That's okay, because the probability of identifying a rookie that is going to be a success is so small relative to the returns that you can enjoy by investing in serially successful people that oversight's irrelevant.
Yeah, okay. That's one thing I've learned from Jordan, as he says his first thing on the list is look at management.
It's all
about. Do they
have
a track record?
And the track record has to be appropriate. I've said this for years, but you have somebody who comes to me and says, Rick, I've been a success in gold mining. And I say, how so? I operated a gold mine in Archean terrain in French-speaking Quebec very successfully. I said, well, that's interesting, because the value proposition that you're giving me now is that you're exploring rather than operating for copper gold in accreted terrain, 15 million year old terrain rather than 20 billion year old terrain in Spanish speaking Peru. How is it that the success that you enjoyed is relevant to the task at hand? So it's important not only that you focus on success, and not only that you focus on the success of the CEO, but rather the success of the chief financial officer. Is he or she able to raise money? Are they able to report in ways that conform with the needs of institutional investors? Do the directors have the cultural sensitivity and the business sensitivity to guide the company in the truest sense, or are they merely there to vote for increasing paydays for the CEO? It's important that you define success fairly specifically and relate it to the task at hand, and in positions that are deeper than just the CEO position.
Yeah, okay. What's his team look like?
Mm-hmm. And why? Why did he choose them? If they're going to operate in Peru, is there somebody there who knows something about Peru? Just out of curiosity, does anybody speak Spanish? That would be good.
Yeah. yeah. Okay, I'd like to move on to precious metals. So to, kind of an outline, humans have decided for thousands of years that, that gold and silver are money. Governments over thousands of years have created fake money to replace that, whether they dilute it with copper or they, you know, have a paper paper currency. Whenever they tend to do this in excess, once the general public realizes what's happening to their currency, gold and silver do an accounting. You believe that we're approaching a moment such as this. Is that correct?
You know, I'm not one of these who necessarily thinks that we're going to have a great reset that takes place over a week. What I believe is that the benign circumstance that we've existed in for 40 years is over. And I believe that that's going to require other measures for people to protect themselves, one of which is gold and silver. As you suggest, in my experience, precious metals prices have done well, particularly when investors and savers are concerned about the maintenance of their purchasing power in conventional savings and investment assets. Yes, war can move gold for a while. You know, social concerns, riots and stuff can move gold for a while. But what really has moved precious metals in my lifetime, studying it going back to 1970, has been the concerns that various societies might have of the maintenance of their purchasing power in fiat instruments, particularly fiat instruments in the world's reserve currency, the US dollar. So let's examine why people might be concerned. Let's make the case, if you will, for gold. Why might people be concerned? The first, apologies to your listeners who have heard me drone on with this before, but it's important for those who haven't. The first is quantitative easing. If you did it, if you printed Bartons, that would be counterfeiting and you'd be thrown in the slammer. But if you were Congressman Barton, it would be policy. It would be highly popular with the electorate and you would be reelected. Whether or not it's policy, it's counterfeiting. Apparently, more than 30% of all the US currency units, US dollars in existence, have come into existence in the last 30 months. This can't be in response to the fact that the economy has grown by 30% in the last 30 months because it hasn't. This is counterfeiting. They simply printed more units, by definition, devaluing the existing units that were out there. That's concerning. If the value of something that you are denominating your savings in goes down, the purchasing power of your savings goes down. This is not tough to figure out, not rocket science. But it gets worse, Steve, from my viewpoint. Debt and deficits. At the federal level, I'm just talking about the United States now, not for your international audience, at the federal level, we have the dubious achievement now of having $30 trillion in on-balance sheet liabilities. For those guests who are math challenged, that's 12 zeros. Now, admittedly, it's only $22 trillion net of counterfeiting, which is to say net of the Federal Reserve balance sheet. So if you're okay with quantitative easing, then our net debt is only $22 trillion because we counterfeited eight. But that isn't the real difficulty. The real difficulty is the net present value of off-balance sheet liabilities. Look at me, Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security. The federal government's estimate of the net present value of entitlements, not the terminal value, the net present value, is over $120 trillion. So if you add the on-balance sheet liabilities and the off-balance sheet liabilities, all of a sudden we're at the sunny side of $140 trillion. And we're going to service this with a budget that's $3 trillion a year in deficit. In other words, we ain't going to service it. We're going to roll it. Now, I learned a little ditty when I was brought up. It goes like this. When your outgo exceeds your income, your upkeep becomes your downfall. And if you think about $140 trillion in debt serviced by savings of negative $3 trillion a year, you understand that our upkeep, our lifestyle, is going to be our downfall. I'm not going to say it's going to happen tomorrow, but I am going to say it's something that I'm concerned about if I'm owning 10-year or 30-year treasuries. Yeah. But it gets worse. The thing that really ought to scare you is the explicit guarantee by the U.S. government that your purchasing power is going to decline. Here's the arithmetic. The world's leading savings and investment instrument is the U.S. 10-year treasury. It's the security by which all others are priced. The arithmetic around the U.S. Treasury is sobering, to say the least, for an investor. The U.S. government guarantees, and I believe them for once, that they're going to pay you 2% on this because they can print, right? They don't have to earn it. They can just print it. So they're going to do that. They're going to pay you 2% a year for 10 years. In a currency that, depending on which alphabet soup agency you believe, is declining in purchasing power by between 6.5% and 7.5% a year. In other words, they guarantee you, and I believe them, that they are going to cost you between 4% and 6% a year on the purchasing power of your savings. Guaranteed. My friend Jim Grant calls that return-free risk. Further back in history, Hayek called them certificates of guaranteed confiscation. If there is anything that ought to concern somebody about the ongoing purchasing power of their savings, it ought to be the explicit promise of the U.S. government to deprive them of those savings. This is the first promise they've made me in 69 years on Earth that I'm absolutely confident that they're going to keep. And it's a chilling prospect for me. But it gets more interesting than that. Maybe not worse, but more interesting. You know that the market share of precious metals and precious metals equities is at an almost all-time low. The market share of precious metals and precious metals equities, I think it's according to JP Morgan Chase, no friends of gold and silver, are less than 0.5% of the total savings and investment assets in the United States, down from a three-decade mean of 1.5%. Now, I suggest to you that the combination of quantitative easing, debt and deficits, and negative real interest rates means that in a recovery, precious metals should probably overshoot their three-decade mean. But let's assume mean reversion. Let's just assume mean reversion. If we experience mean reversion, demand for precious metals and precious metals related assets in a market which is 24% of the world's economy would triple or quadruple.
But from 0.5% to 1.5%
or 1.5% or 2%. Yeah. The biggest thing, and maybe the reason why I think this will occur, is that 40 years of benign economic circumstance have taught the largest investors in the world, the sovereign wealth funds, the pension funds, the insurance companies, the endowments, to look at an asset allocation model that was roughly 60% equity, 40% debt. These guys are between a rock and a hard spot. The 40% of their portfolio that provided stability to their portfolio now guarantees them the inability to discharge their charter. If you are being paid 2% in US treasuries in a currency where your purchasing power is depreciating by 6.5%, you are guaranteed not to be able to fund people's pensions on an inflation indexed basis. You're guaranteed not to be able to maintain Stanford University. You are guaranteed not to be able to provide adequate lifestyle to future generations of Norwegians if you are Norsk Bank. And there is going to have to be disintermediation out of debt markets as to 40% of this asset class. And some of that, I suspect, if people are looking to hedge themselves against the negative impacts of inflation, which they would be, would find its way into precious metals. I'm not suggesting that 40% of the world's institutional savings are going to go into gold. That's not what I'm suggesting at all. I'm suggesting that after 40 years of declining interest rates, that game is over. And that there will be disintermediation out of debt instruments and precious metals will be a beneficiary. That's all I'm suggesting. But I think the combination of those five factors means that although it isn't a certainty that precious metals and precious metals equities do well, it's such an overwhelming probability that people who don't avail themselves of the opportunity are just bad at math.
I like that. Of the four commodities, uranium, gold, silver, and oil, which one, maybe if you could put those in order as far as when you believe the timeline on those, I'm thinking uranium's probably first.
I mean, oil's first. It's 2 years ago.
That ship has sailed.
It isn't over because the oil stocks are priced as though oil was selling for $55 a barrel and selling for $100. the amount of cash these guys are generating is unbelievable. Yeah. I mean, it's unbelievable. So the first is oil. It has moved and it is still moving. And if you're an income investor, the oil companies are literally making money so fast they can't reinvest it. They have to give it back to shareholders. It's coming in such incredible quantities that figuratively they're drowning in money, which is a wonderful thing.
It's a good problem to have.
And I don't see in the near term, because it takes so much capital to increase production, and because the oil company managements are so nervous about politics, that it's constraining their reinvestments, and there's a challenge to Russian supplies, I don't see the price changing dramatically in the near term, and the companies are swimming in cash. So if you're an investor, not a speculator, looking at things like Exxon and Chevron, well, there's no guarantee that anything in the world will work. Boy, the arithmetic around the oil market, if you're an investor, not a speculator, is superb. Now, from a speculator's point of view, you go to the other end of the spectrum. You go right straight to uranium. It isn't merely that people are bored by it. They hate it. When you advocate uranium from a public podium, people will criticize you from the audience. They will shout out, you're defending Chernobyl. You're defending Hiroshima, Nagasaki, and Three Mile Island. If you're a contrarian, that's the highest praise you can get. I mean, you look for boredom and you savor hate. And around uranium, there's a lot of hate, which is a very good thing. But people forget, most people in the world, when they walk into a room, irrespective of their memory of Fukushima, when they hit the switch, they want the lights to come on. And without uranium, there will come a time, not too far from now, when the lights don't come on. Either the price of uranium clears the total cost of production, including the cost of capital and prior year write-downs, or the lights go out. It's as simple as that. German consumers are finding this out. German consumers figured out that they, or thought that they had the leverage, pardon me, the ability, the wealth, that they didn't have to have uranium. They've confronted two new realities. The first is that their electric bills have quintupled. The second is that despite their green coating, they're burning a whole bunch more coal than they used to. So in their sort of hypocrisy, they have learned that the laws of physics, as an example, work. And they work around uranium. Uranium is timely now. When I advocated uranium stocks 3 years ago, they were felony cheap. Really, 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 really cheap. And I knew the price of uranium had to go up, but I didn't know when it had to go up. A couple things have happened. The first is that 3 years have passed. 3 years where uranium supply was in deficit and the above ground stocks of uranium got turned into watts and volts, which is a very good thing. The second thing that happened is that my former firm, Sprott, launched a product called the Sprott Physical Uranium Trust, which succeeded beyond anybody, including my own wildest dreams, in tightening up the spot market. But the third is the most important, which is to say the winds of political change, particularly in Japan, has meant that the pace of Japanese restarts, the second largest nuclear fleet in the world, has transferred from someday to 2022. That's the real catalyst. While all that has happened, while the outlook for uranium has become better, the price of many uranium stocks has fallen by half. The hot money, who didn't understand why they did it, who probably couldn't spell uranium, have now exited it in favor of who knows what. Yeah. So at the same time that the outlook has become clear and the timeline has become tight, the price of admission has fallen by half. So from a speculator's viewpoint, uranium's extremely attractive.
Yes. Okay. And I've heard you say before, gold moves before silver, but when silver goes, it's exponential. And when you look over the history of the graph, that it's very easy to see.
Yeah, unfortunately, Steve, we have to descend into narrative now. I can only say that I've observed it. I can't tell you why. Okay. With oil, I can tell you why. With uranium, I can tell you why. With silver, I can only tell you that. I have a suspicion as to why. My suspicion is that the unit cost of silver is lower. So that frontier and emerging market savers who don't have the ability to protect themselves in gold can afford the lower unit cost of silver, and there are more of them. But that's only a suspicion. I do know when I look back at the precious metals bull markets and mini markets that I've been part of, that gold has moved first, that when gold has established momentum, silver has moved in the second half of the market, but it's moved further and faster. And I would say, too, that the most explosive asset class that I know of in precious metals are high-quality silver equities.
Okay.
They are, the market cap, the combined market cap is so small, and they're leveraged to the silver price so high. My friend Doug Casey told me years ago that the market caps are so small that when the pool of generalist capital finally comes into the space, that the market caps of the silver companies can't accommodate it. And he described it colorfully as attempting to siphon Hoover Dam through a garden hose. I've had the good fortune to experience this twice now, and I would like to experience it one more time before I shed my mortal coil.
But, you mean things like First Majestic or Pan American?
Yeah. I mean, some of the penny dreadfuls will do well, too. There will be a couple of silver discoveries. I think the mistake that people make is they think that they need to take too much risk in the market. Too many people buy companies that are looking for silver as opposed to companies that have silver. My experience has been that just capturing the beta, the difference between the silver market and the broad market, is enough, because the silver market does so much for you. You don't need to take extra risk to capture alpha, particularly when you're taking company risk. Buying the best is really all you need do. If you want to take more risk, that's fine, but then be prepared to do a lot of work and suffer a lot of volatility and perhaps real risk.
Okay. For our non-accredited investors, does it really matter what brokerage account we use, whether it's Vanguard, Fidelity, Schwab, Interactive Brokers?
I have found for my purposes that Interactive Brokers serves me the best, because I can buy in exchanges around the world. I don't have to buy London listed stocks in the US over the counter market. I can buy them in London. I can buy Australian stocks in Australia. Till a couple of days ago, I could buy Russian stocks in Russia.
Yeah.
So for me, Interactive Brokers works well. I need to say that the customer interface, that is the way that Interactive Brokers deals with its customers, I think they like to keep us sullen, but not yet mutinous. The website is horrific. Customer service is even worse. But as a platform for availing yourself of equity markets around the world 24/7, it's fantastic. I am becoming pickier than I used to be about brokerage accounts, because as I spend more time looking at the financial statements and income sheets of major financial services firms, I become increasingly concerned about the prospect of illiquidity among the big companies. Unfortunately, there's no good ones. When I chose a clearing firm for Sprott, I chose RBC Dane solely because of solvency. I looked at the Dane balance sheet, and the first thing I saw was that their derivatives exposure was only to hedge their interest rate and equity risks. They weren't dealers or traders in derivatives. And I understood Dane's derivatives exposure relative to shareholders' equity. When I look at that same number with the JP Morgan Chases or the Wells Fargo or the Banks of America's of the world, the idea that they're taking even notional derivatives exposure in the $200 trillion range with shareholder equity of $300 billion, the idea that 0.1% equity slice is sufficient to defend me against this derivatives exposure, it may be, but I'm not smart enough to know. The second thing that bothers me increasingly is the time spread that financial institutions are taking. Funding 5 or 7 year fixed rate loans, funding them in the overnight deposit market, borrowing short and lending long. When a bank funds, let's say, a 5 year mini term commercial mortgage at a fixed rate, and they're funding that with now deposits, demand deposits, and in the overnight market, it means that if you have a liquidity squeeze like 2008, where the overnight market dries up, they have the obligation, but they don't have the money. Or if the interest rate were to rise, they receive a fixed rate, but they pay a floating rate. I'm not saying that this is going to be ugly. What I'm saying is I don't want to take the chance. I don't like time spreads, although time spreads are immensely profitable right now. If you're putting out, you know, 5-year money for 3.75 and you're funding it at 25 basis point, your net lending spread relative to your deposit charge is the highest in banking history. It's also, from my point of view, the riskiest in banking history. So I don't have a sense of humor for that.
Yeah, I've noticed myself spreading out my variance a little bit by, I think I have 4 different brokerage accounts now.
Right. I've done the same thing with bank accounts. You know, I have bank accounts at these little obscure banks like Bank of Hemet or Farmers and Merchants Bank of Long Beach. Now that I'm an old man, I prefer my banks to have money in them. I want shareholders' equity to be a fairly large amount relative to deposit liabilities or assets under administration. And I've found myself in the position of saying, yeah, balance sheets matter, at least to me.
Speaking of banks, you're starting up, I believe, your 7th bank now called Battle Bank, and you're actually going to base it on real things like gold and silver. Is that correct?
Yeah, I've been a bank investor for a very long time. Banking is a wonderful business if you don't get greedy. One mistake undoes 12 or 14 successes in banking. So the idea isn't to chase success so much as to minimize failure. And it isn't a hard business if you do that. So yes, I'm participating now in my 7th bank startup. To look at the bank startup, you need to dial back to 1999 when a new bank called EverBank was actually thought up on my living room floor in Carlsbad, California. EverBank was a distance bank, meaning that it didn't have any bricks and mortars. That it took deposits and made loans via the internet. It was an idea ahead of its time, but because of their innovative product suite, in particular deposit products that were denominated in things like gold or silver or equity indexes or foreign currencies, and because they limited their lending to businesses that they understood, in other words, they assisted on collateral, the bank grew very fast, and over 15 years, the bank grew from a standing start on my living room floor to $28 billion in assets, went public on the New York Stock Exchange, and was ultimately sold to TIAA CREF, a big pension company. They bought it, first of all, for the size of the business, but they bought it for the platform because they had 1.5 million customers. And they didn't need the formidable marketing platform that EverBank had created. They didn't need the deposit suite either because they had their own customers. So TIAA CREF has, by the way, they've done a great job with the bank and it's done a great job servicing their members. But all the things that made EverBank special were of no value to TIAA CREF. And so the old team from EverBank has reunited with my backing and we're forming something called Battle Bank. The acronym is simple. We battle for you. We battle for your deposits. Where the comptroller of currency suggests that 7% is a well-capitalized bank, I like the sound of 10 or 11 better than I like the sound of 7. I'm not smart enough to have my bank have a bunch of derivatives, except for maybe to hedge interest rates. And I'm certainly not smart enough to engage in time spreads. I'm not smart enough to borrow short and lend long. That is just not my idea of a good time. So we are looking forward to recreating, in some measure, updated for the time, EverBank. I certainly wish we would have had the bank alive 3 weeks ago. One of the things that EverBank had was Canadian dollar deposits. And I suspect that Mr. Trudeau's action would have driven a substantial number of Canadian dollar depositors south of the border to a bank that was beyond their prime minister's pale. Unfortunately, we weren't quick enough off the dime to catch that. But my suspicion is that we'll take advantage of some other government miscues in the next 5 years.
Oh, I'm sure there'll be plenty of them.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say, given the orientation of everybody around EverBank, that things like lending against physical precious metals and precious metals denominated CDs, I think that this bank will have a decided precious metals tilt. That isn't to say it's going to be a gold bank. We're going to service our depositors. But the people who are naturally attracted to doing business with us are very often people who believe, for the same reason that we do, in the efficacy of precious metals in a whole portfolio.
Very cool. Very cool. I want to get your quick opinion on water. I have a poker group that I play once a month, and we're all professionals, and we're essentially just trading money with each other. But it's more of a think tank than it really is, you know, a way to. Anyhow, we always talk about stuff. We're talking about uranium. And then we asked the guy, Mike Davis, I had him on the show, very successful guy, owns a bunch of Jack in the Boxes, used to be an actuary, just a real entrepreneur. We asked him, he's the longest in the tooth of all of us and by far the most successful. And we asked him what he thought about where the world is going. And he said water. And he said, in time, that's going to be the most valuable resource. He says, I probably won't live to see it. You guys might. And we're like, well, what would you do? Is it like, is there an ETF for that? And he's like, maybe. And I thought, I remember you mentioned J.G. Boswell. You mentioned Limoneira. I'm actually into Limoneira just because they're right here near me in Santa Paula. And I like that they own the water rights. What are your thoughts on water?
Well, you've given me license for a wonderful pun. Water is the best of all investment classes, except that it's illiquid. I've been a water rights buyer and an agricultural land buyer in California for 35 years, which is how I came upon Boswell and Limoneira. Okay. They did it better publicly than I did it privately. Water is risky too, because it's allocated politically. Water should flow downhill to utility. That is to say, if in an economy, flushing a toilet is more valuable than growing alfalfa in the desert, then the urban user would pay more for water and they would have more water than the rural user. But that's not the way it works. Water flows uphill to votes. And the consequence of that is that we grow rice in the desert. Water rights, which I used to be able to buy fairly easily, have been bought up. I mean, they're effectively gone. So the way that you get water now is that you buy land that either has water titled to it or has in situ subterranean water. That's complicated because in California, at least, and by the way, you want to own water in places where it's scarce. It isn't too tough to buy water in northern Canada where the challenge is to make it go away. But you need to buy it in places where it's scarce, and you need to buy it in places where it's scarce that they can afford it. You know, water in Eritrea isn't worth too much either because people can't buy it from you. But in places like California, where it's both scarce and where the place is rich, title to water is obscured politically. So water, as an example, that's titled to agriculture can sometimes be sold, but it has to be sold to agricultural uses. The thing that's beautiful about Limoneira is that when the titled use of land changes, the titled use of the water changes too. So right now, Limoneira uses water to grow lemons and avocados and vegetables and flowers, all good things, all good things. But when that land changes its use from row crop to single family residential or commercial, the use of the water, the titled use of the water, can go from agricultural to urban, which means that water that might otherwise be worth $250 or $300 a foot suddenly becomes worth $1,000 or $1,200 a foot. Or, if nothing else happens, at least permits the entitlement of land from agricultural to commercial, because the political class understands that the water to service those users will be available.
Okay. Can you go over your what you do with the portfolio review? I've done this several times and has cued me into things that I never would have known had I not gotten your opinion.
Sure.
Give that out to our listeners.
Sure. For the listeners who don't know, in my retirement, one of the things that amuses me is investor education, and I do it for free. If you care what I think about natural resources, in particular the natural resources which are important to you because you own them, go to a website, ruleinvestmentmedia.com. That's all one word, ruleinvestmentmedia.com. Enter your natural resource stocks. Please, no cryptocurrencies, no tech stocks, no marijuana stocks, just resource stocks. I'll rank them 1 to 10, 1 being best, 10 being worst. Understand that the ranks are subject to rapid change because as we've just seen in Russia, circumstances change. I will comment on individual issues where I think that my comments might have value, and I'll send it back to you on a no obligations basis. Further, when you look on the forum that you'll put your stocks on, you'll see questions and comments. If you write charts, I will send back to you the Barron's Gold Mining Index chart, which is the longest running and most inclusive gold equities index in the world. Not because I'm a technical analyst, but rather because the anatomy of a precious metals bull market is best understood by looking at history. And this chart is the best tool I know. And I'll send you a 110-year commodity chart that just talks about just how cheap various commodity classes are relative to other asset classes going back 110 years. Further, two more things I'll do all of a sudden. Because I'm starting a bank and because some people care, if you say bank, I'll put you on a list to find out more about our bank, if, as, and when we get our charter. And finally, I've learned that I can talk about private placements. When I was a licensed person, I couldn't. I had no commercial freedom of speech, and I was deemed to be soliciting. But now that I don't get paid, I'm not soliciting. So if you are an accredited investor and you care about private placements, if you write placements in the question or comment line, I'll put you on a list to receive information about every placement that I personally do with my own money. That doesn't mean because I got in that you can get in, but it means that you can try. It also doesn't mean that you should, because I did. I've been known to make catastrophic mistakes in the past. But if you care about what I'm doing with my own money in the microcap resource place space, and you can afford the risk of private placements because you're accredited, and you care, write placements in the comment line. So that's charts, bank, placements.
Awesome, thank you. And I'm really looking forward to your uranium boot camp, sir. This is going to be a lot of fun. Can you listen, we'll put the links in the show notes? Can you touch on that?
This is easy. This is really topical. I mean, the time is now. The whole set of circumstances around uranium has shifted to fast forward at the same time that the share prices have fallen in many cases by 50 or 60%. I've graded 7,000 or 8,000 portfolios in the last 2 years that had a strong uranium bias. And I've learned a lot about what people know and don't know about uranium. They often get the strategy right, but the tactics are very lacking. So the consequence of that is that we're putting on an 8-hour online bootcamp for uranium investors, talking about where I see the shortcomings in portfolios. We'll have the best overview of the uranium market I have ever seen by WMC consultants. They did it for the Sprott board. And they just knocked my socks off. What they were able to do for fairly sophisticated people who didn't know about uranium in 1 hour was amazing. So that's the way we'll start. We'll have a discussion from a former U.S. Energy Secretary about the politics worldwide of uranium, because uranium is nothing if not political. The Chinese view of uranium is important because they're the largest new consumer. And so we'll have a spokesman from China General Nuclear, the Chinese parastatal nuclear company, talk about the Chinese outlook on uranium. We'll have the largest uranium company in the world, Kazatomprom, with 42% of world production, talking about global supply and demand and the economics of uranium mining. We'll have the largest market capitalization uranium company in the world, Cameco, talking about the structure of the uranium industry and uranium investment decision-making in North America. We will have analysts who have been in the uranium space for 20 years. So many of the online analysts today, 3 or 4 years ago, couldn't spell uranium. Today, they're experts. That I think it's important that you have seasoned people who have been through the booms and the busts, who have enjoyed successes and endured failures in the past. We'll do all that. This is 8 hours long. It's on March 19th. It's okay if you can't watch it on March 19th. This information won't be stale on April 1st. I guarantee it. $99, money back guarantee. If you sit through the presentation and you don't believe that you've got your money's worth, email me and I'll send you your money back. 100%, no questions asked, money back guarantee.
This is a pretty cool offer. Awesome. Thank you, Mr. Rule. This has been a lot of fun. Very informative.
It's going to be so much fun. I've had so much fun with my team putting this together, learning from people who are going to be on my faculty, who should be on my faculty that I didn't know yet, talking to various investors about what they'd like to learn about, and in particular, going over these portfolios and seeing what people got right and what people got wrong.
Yeah. You got the heavy hitters come into the class. That's going to be fun. That's going to be fun. Well, thank you, Mr. Rule. I really appreciate it. And we'll have to do this again, sir.
Always a pleasure, particularly if you have a sense of humor for the valuation discussions. I love to do them, but they often leave listeners crying in boredom. So
yeah, that would be a really neat show to do.
If you're willing to take the risk, I'm willing to do it.
Okay, awesome. Okay, well, thank you, sir.
Okay.
All right, you have a great rest of the day.
Pleasure. Thank you for the opportunity to talk to your audience.
Yes, my pleasure. Bye-bye.